VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Two officials involved in talks said on Tuesday that Hamas has accepted a draft agreement for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and the release of dozens of hostages. AP correspondent Joe Fetterman has more from Jerusalem.
Israel and Hamas appear to be on the cusp of a ceasefire deal that would end over 15 months of war. Hamas officials say they've accepted a draft of the proposal. The Israelis say there still is no deal, but they're also voicing optimism as final details are being worked out. Qatar, the Mideast country that's been mediating the talks, say the sides have not been this close to an agreement in months. The proposal lays out a multi-stage process for ending a war that has killed over 46,000 Palestinians, 1,600 Israelis, and also caused widespread devastation in Gaza. The first stage calls for a gradual pullback of Israeli troops from most of Gaza over 6 weeks in exchange for the freedom of 33 hostages held by Hamas. Displaced Palestinians would also begin to go home, and aid would pour into Gaza. The sides also would quickly enter negotiations on a second phase meant to end the war altogether. That would mean a final pullout of remaining Israeli troops and the return of roughly 70 other hostages. Now, it remains unclear who will run Gaza in the long run and who is going to pay for the badly needed reconstruction, but negotiators are hoping that this initial phase will create the momentum to address these deeper issues.
AP correspondent Joe Fetterman. Officials have expressed optimism before, only for negotiations to stall while the warring sides blamed each other. But they now suggest they can conclude an agreement ahead of the January 20th inauguration of U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, whose Mideast envoy has joined the negotiations. This is VOA News. Southern California faces new wildfire warnings after flames the past week killed at least 24 people and destroyed thousands of homes. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Firefighting officials in the Los Angeles area say they're ready for the Santa Ana winds to whip up and possibly spread flames. County Fire Chief Anthony Maroney.
The anticipated winds combined with low humidities and low fuel moistures will keep the fire threat in the LA region critical.
City Fire Chief Kristen Crowley says they're pre-positioning for any new wildfires.
We're carefully managing our operations to ensure that we can quickly respond to any new fires in addition to the increased call volume.
They continue to say until it's safe, many residents can't go back and check on homes. And L.A. County Sheriff Robert Luna warning residents to be ready for more evacuations so there's no repeat of last week.
A lot of the people that were rescued who waited till the last minute to leave the order or the evacuation order, many of them had significant burns on them.
And law enforcement officials say arrests continue for things like looting, trespass, curfew, and three people who tried to start small fires that were immediately extinguished were arrested on arson charges. I'm Julie Walker.
U.S. Special Counsel Jack Smith says in a report that his team stood up for the rule of law as it investigated President-elect Trump's efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Smith says he stands behind his decision to bring criminal charges against Trump and believes the Republican would have been convicted had he not won the 2024 election. Trump says he's totally innocent. The White House announced on Tuesday that President Joe Biden has notified Congress of his intent to lift the U.S. designation of Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
It's part of a deal facilitated by the Catholic Church to free political prisoners on the island. The U.S. will also ease some economic pressure on Cuba. President Obama had reversed the terror designation in 2016 during a period of thawing relations with Havana, which included a visit to the Cuban capital. President Biden's move to lift it again is likely to be reversed as early as next week once Trump takes office, with Secretary of State Marco Rubio, whose family left Cuba before Fidel Castro came to power. Sagar Magani, Washington.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Buck in Washington. Today's Wednesday, January 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A South African rescue operation brings illegal miners and dead bodies to the surface.
We literally begged the government to say, could you please just save them, take them and put them to the surface. Then you can further process them in terms of the criminality that you are saying they have committed.
Kenyan rights groups blame the police for an increase in abductions of government critics. Sierra Leone declares a public health emergency after confirming two mpox cases. UNICEF says child abuse conditions are worsening for thousands of children and women in conflict-ravaged areas of the DRC. A new legal wrinkle arises in the trial of Ugandan opposition leader Kizza Besigye.
It appeared that the judge advocate, who is an advisor of the court, had hijacked the court and was making rulings instead of advice. It was a very frustrating day.
And hopes for Gaza ceasefire deal are still high, but timing is uncertain. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rescue operations are underway at a gold mine in South Africa's northwest province. Hundreds of illegal miners have been underground for months, and many have already died, as Kate Bartlett reports from Stilfontein.
More than 50 bodies were brought to the surface at a South African gold mine, police confirmed on Tuesday, as operations to rescue hundreds of illegal miners still trapped underground continued. More than 60 people were brought up alive. The illegal miners, known in South Africa as zamazamas, or those who take a chance, have been down the unused mine shaft for more than 2 months after police launched an operation to crack down on the illegal activity. At first, authorities said the miners were refusing to resurface to avoid arrest, but civil society groups say they are unable to get back to the surface as they are too weak from starvation. A court last week ordered the government to launch a rescue operation, which started Monday. But Muzukisi Jam, a civil society activist who has been involved in rescue operations, said it was too little, too late.
Our volunteers confirmed with us yesterday that there are more than 400 live illegal miners who are still trapped. And our own volunteers confirmed who went down there that there are more than 100 dead bodies underground.
Police have not confirmed how many miners, living or dead, remain trapped. But Jam said the tragedy could have been prevented.
We literally begged the government to say, could you please just save them, take them and put them to the surface. Then you can further process them in terms of criminality that you are saying they have committed.
Protesters gathered outside the mine Tuesday, decrying the government's stance. But the police minister and minister of mineral resources and energy, who visited the rescue site on Tuesday, defended the government's actions.
I've not changed my views that illegal mining is a criminal activity. Once there is a criminal activity, there is a crime scene. It should be intensifying the fight against illegal mining.
That was Gwede Mantashe, mineral resources minister, who said illegal mining was an attack on the economy. He said in 2024, the illicit precious metal trade was estimated at over $3 billion. But for Zinzi Tom, whose 26-year-old brother is still down the mine, all that matters is that he comes out alive.
They told us that he's not in good condition. He's been there for... The guy who was with him is saying that he last saw him 2 weeks ago. It's a very sad moment, but one thing that I told myself is that I pray to God to give me strength. I have to make sure that he's okay and pray to God.
Illegal miners like her brother are forced to eke out a dangerous living underground because of high unemployment, she said. Some are South African, but many others are from neighboring countries like Lesotho and Mozambique. Experts say that while the actual zamazamas taking the risks make little money, the criminal syndicates who run illegal operations are getting rich. The rescue operation is expected to take 10 days. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Stilfontein, Northwest Province, South Africa.
Human rights groups in Kenya are blaming the police for a recent increase in the abductions of critics who have protested government policies. The activists say at least 29 people are missing after raising concerns about poor governance. Victoria Amunga has more from Nairobi.
Kenyan cartoonist Gideon Kibet recounts an ordeal in December 2024 when he says unknown people trailed him to a bus on his way from a meeting in the capital, Nairobi. Kibet says he was forced into a car and driven for kilometers. He says, I heard a lady asking, where are you? Suddenly, four men sprang up and they put me into a car. He says they had masked themselves. They tore my shirt and used it to blindfold me. They also tied my hands. Kibet has drawn cartoons mocking government figures such as President William Ruto. One caricature which depicted the president in a coffin went viral. Kibet's case is among 82 others of abductions and forced disappearances in just 6 months, according to the Kenya National Commission of Human Rights. Although Kibet and four others have been released, that has not been the case for dozens of others. Kenya has witnessed up to 44% increase in abductions between September 2023 and August 2024, according to the National Security Report. Officials say that the number is up from 36% between September 2022 and August 2023. Many of the victims are critics of bad governance, say right groups. Irungu Horton is the executive director for Amnesty International Kenya.
What we're seeing essentially is the use of extrajudicial power to cause fear among either citizens that are legitimately protesting against bad governance or raising their concerns with government.
Some Kenyans have taken to social media in protest of the government on issues including increase in taxes and corruption. But in a public event Sunday, Interior Cabinet Secretary Kipchumba Murkomen termed the critics as criminals. He denied police involvement in the abductions.
If the criminals and people with bad behavior have moved from being manual to the digital space, I want to tell them we will follow you there. Because that is where we want to ensure that there is law and order.
Kenyan lawyers have petitioned the country's High Court to hold the Inspector General of Police responsible for the abductions. According to the lawyers, the state is evading accountability. Gloria Kimani is a member of the Law Society of Kenya.
Our question has been, from July till today, no investigation has been done. No investigation has been cleared. And we are not being told the people who are responsible.
Inspector General of Police Douglas Kanja and the Director of Criminal Investigations Mohamed Amin are expected to appear in court this Friday regarding the abductions. The two have snubbed three previous court summons in the abduction cases. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
The trial of Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye and his co-accused Obey Lutale resumed on Tuesday in a military court. Besigye's wife has said that the two were kidnapped in Kenya and brought back to Uganda. They are charged with the unlawful possession of ammunition and a firearm. In a surprising move on Tuesday, the military introduced a new charge of treachery or treason against the two. The court also amended the charge sheet to include a third accused person. Former Kenyan Justice Minister Martha Karua is the leader of the 32-member defense team. She tells me that Tuesday was a very frustrating day in court for the defense.
We argued our objections, our application to have the case referred to the Constitutional Court in accordance with Article 137.5 of the Uganda Constitution. That clause is mandatory. The issue we were conversing, they had ruled that they have jurisdiction to try the accused. And our argument is that they have no jurisdiction because the Constitution does not expressly or by implication give the UPDF, the Uganda People Defense Forces, jurisdiction over civil or criminal trials of civilians. They had all those arguments and then just dismissed them and did not refer us to the Constitutional Court. We wanted to appeal against their dismissal of our application. The right to appeal is expressly given by the UPDF Act. They rejected that. And it appeared that the judge advocate, who is an advisor of the court, had hijacked the court and was making rulings instead of advice. It was a very frustrating day, and it is clear that the general court martial is not following any known procedure.
What exactly is the charge of treachery? Because there's an article here that says that the military court introduced a new charge of treachery.
The charge of treachery is a vague or nebulous charge. Treachery is also similar to treason and actually connotes betrayal. It means the prosecution is on a fishing expedition. It's trying to suggest a conspiracy between the accused or amongst the accused persons.
What can you tell us about the addition of Captain Dennis Ola to the charge sheet? Did the defense know about him before today?
The addition of Captain Ola was a surprise to all of us. To begin with, Captain Ola has been in custody since October, I'm told, 2023, when he was arrested and charged in the court-martial, along with other civilians. I'm told about 30 or 37 people. They're already charged with offenses relating to security. They've been in custody all that time. If you look at the charges affecting our clients who were abducted in Nairobi last November, it is for offenses alleged to have been committed in Greece, Switzerland, and Kenya. One wonders whether Captain Ola met them before his arrest in October 2023 or later. We are waiting to see. Today, our clients declined to plead to the charges because they still hold that the court has no jurisdiction and they would have wanted the Constitutional Court to pronounce itself on all the matters raised, including the issue of access or facilitation to have lawyer of choice. And as you can see, the arbitrariness of the court martial, the lack of failure to follow procedure, failure to work according to the law, adversely affects the accused persons. These are our issues, and we feel that we may not get justice in this court.
Former Kenyan Justice Minister Martha Karua is the leader of the 32-member defense team for Ugandan opposition leader Kizza Besigye. She was speaking with us from Kampala. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Wednesday, January 15. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The UN Child Protection Agency, UNICEF, is warning that child abuse is worsening for thousands of children and women in conflict-ravaged areas of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Ramatou Touré, UNICEF's DRC Chief of Child Protection, told viewers Chinedu Ofor that the year is beginning on a grim note.
Unfortunately, we have seen in the new year that, especially in the eastern part of the country, that the situation has further deteriorated, and we are seeing now massive displacement, but also violence for children. What this conflict means for children in those regions is basically three things. It means first that they are at the risk of being separated from their families. Then the second risk is they are at risk, of course, of recruitment by armed group, but also women and girls and also boys actually are at increased risk of sexual violence.
And talking of sexual violence, I know this is one area that is of most concern to you and to the international community. What is the current situation?
The current situation is actually twofold. On one side, we've seen from last year, especially, a tremendous partnership, tremendous efforts in the DRC to prevent and respond to sexual violence, especially to prevent and respond to sexual violence against girls and against children, which had brought a large coalition from government counterparts, from our partners, from UNICEF. Obviously, we are at the forefront of those efforts to prevent and respond concretely to the plight of sexual violence, but we are also seeing, of course, that those crimes continue continue, and especially in the areas that are affected by the conflict. So right now we are at a crossroad in the DRC where basically there is awareness that sexual violence is highly prevalent. We do have the mechanisms and the tools because we know how to prevent it. We know how to respond to it. So what we are doing now is scaling up and expanding our services, expanding the different coalitions, the different partnerships, and expanding our programs to be able to respond better, but also more importantly, to be able to have the seeds of long-lasting prevention against sexual violence.
Last year, you held a conference where you brought several parties to the table to discuss especially enforcement of sexual violence crimes against women and children. How is that working out, and is it even possible to enforce it?
Last year we had this major conference. Actually, it was the first national conference against violence against children in the DRC, and it was focused mainly on sexual violence. One of the areas that we're looking at is indeed the fight against impunity. Yes, it is possible. We have seen major examples where actually perpetrators of sexual violence against children have been brought to justice. But what we need to do is to make sure that not only for the perpetrators, but for the whole community, perpetrating sexual violence against children or women is seen by everyone as a crime.
That's Ramatu Ture, UNICEF DRC Chief of Child Protection, was speaking from Kinshasa with VOA's Chinedu Ofor. Sierra Leone's Minister of Information says his country is taking all necessary steps to deal with an outbreak of the mpox disease. This after the country declared a public health emergency this week after confirming two mpox cases in the capital, Freetown. Sierra Leone is the latest country in West Africa to report the disease after neighboring Liberia, Cote d'Ivoire, and Guinea. Information Minister Chernah Ba tells me that Sierra Leone is prepared from its experience with Ebola.
Minister of Health has been consulted with His Excellency the President of the Republic of Sierra Leone, Brigadier Dr. Julius Nadabiu, made what is essentially a mandatory public health emergency. This is necessitated by the fact that we have confirmed two cases of mpox. Those two cases are within the western area vicinity, which is within our capital city. And because of those two confirmed cases, we have had the need, having consulted as well with WHO and other authorities, to declare a national public health emergency in Sierra Leone so that we can immediately activate all the necessary steps, resources, and personnel to respond to this outbreak.
So you said you have two people who have been identified with the disease. What steps has your government taken with those two individuals?
So the two individuals are currently hospitalized at the government Connaught Hospital in the capital city, and they are responding to treatment. I think one of the lessons we have in our country is that we do have experience in responding to public health outbreaks, and we have a system. We have been preparing and planning for these kinds of situations. Our president has just set up a national public health agency over the past year. So what is happening now is we have initiated our response. We have an incident action plan, which means we're doing contact tracing, ensuring that everybody that came into contact with those two cases that we have confirmed, we know where they are. We monitor them over the next couple of weeks as it's the protocol is required. And then the reason we did the public declaration is so that we can also equip our hospitals, make sure that we engage communities as we're doing now with our ministry and the public health agency and the Ministry of Health, make sure that our communities are on high alert.
Minister, you mentioned Sierra Leone's experience with the Ebola. There are reports that this mpox was also in Liberia, Cote d'Ivoire, and Guinea. How concerned?
In fact, in part of our response plan, one of the major areas we're looking at is how do we ensure cross-border control, but also coordinating with our sister countries in the sub-region. What we know from these outbreaks is that once one country is affected, we know that, you know, despite our best efforts, it's very likely that it will affect the neighboring countries. So because of that experience, as you said, there have already been reported cases in Liberia, in Guinea. We were on high alert. We'll be monitoring our borders. What we're doing now is to step that up and ensure that the response mechanism we have put in place, the experience that we have with community mobilization, with engaging our citizens, with making sure that we beat disinformation and misinformation, which is often what comes up with these kinds of things, stigma and making sure people are not afraid. Again, thinking that, oh, it's some terrible thing that they should be afraid to even come forward for. Because of all of those experiences, we believe that we're in a very good position to respond to this outbreak with the cooperation of our citizens, and it's something that we'll defeat very soon.
Information Minister, he was speaking with us from the capital, Freetown. Hopes are still high for a Gaza ceasefire agreement. The Biden administration continues working with its partners to close the deal as it prepares to hand over to the Trump administration. Veronica Balderas Iglesia has the details.
As Gaza endured more Israeli strikes Tuesday, a ceasefire deal appeared close. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken continued to express confidence in the latest proposal brokered by his country, Qatar, and Egypt.
If Hamas accepts, the deal is ready to be concluded and implemented.
$25 billion to Israel in the past year.
Pro-Palestinian demonstrators interrupted Blinken's remarks at the Atlantic Council as he recapped the Biden administration's approach to the Mideast crisis. He spoke about a post-conflict plan that he will hand off to the incoming Trump administration.
That would allow Israel to fully withdraw from Gaza, prevent Hamas from filling back in, and provide for Gaza's governance, security, and reconstruction.
In the near term, reaching a ceasefire deal would benefit all parties in the conflict, President Joe Biden said Monday.
The deal we have structured would free the hostages, halt the fighting, provide security to Israel, and allow us to significantly surge humanitarian assistance to the Palestinians.
Yahya Rashid was displaced from Gaza City. He welcomes the news of a potential truce.
We really hope it happens because our people are in desperate need to take a break from this big burden.
Shay Dixman's cousin was killed in Hamas captivity. He also favors a deal.
Time is of the essence, and we want to be very optimistic that within the few days, even hours, we can get to an agreement.
The latest ceasefire proposal is more specific than previous ones, says Jonathan Rui, director of foreign policy at the Jewish Institute for National Security of America. He was interviewed via Zoom.
Regarding the release of the hostages held by Hamas in Gaza, which specific hostages those would be, and specifically Israel's military posture in Gaza in exchange and in proportion to which hostages are released.
Rui is more optimistic about this ceasefire plan than the previous ones, but he's less optimistic about a permanent solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, saying the parties are too far off to make the necessary hard agreements. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
And that's it for this Wednesday, January 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming on board with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barton in Washington, saying have a lovely day.
Of America on January 20th for comprehensive coverage of the presidential inauguration ceremonies as President-elect Donald John Trump takes the oath of office. From live reporting to expert analysis, VOA brings you every moment as history unfolds. Stay informed, stay connected, only on the Voice of America. On Monday, January 20th, the 47th President of the United States, Donald John Trump, will be sworn into office. VOA will be there and will broadcast the events of the presidential inauguration live, starting at 1600 UTC to audiences around the world.
I pledge that I will be president for all Americans.